You're listening to Green Mountain Medicine, an original podcast series by ACP Vermont for all things internal medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And we're your hosts.
This series aims to unpack the complexity of medicine in a nuanced and evidence-based way. We invite you to relax, grab some coffee, maybe some tea, maybe you're just a water person, and engage with us as we discuss the topics that impact our fields and characterize our practice.
So today we have Dr. Pamela Gibson as our special guest. Katie and I both know Dr. Gibson from the classroom learning environment. CRR was our most recent course, and we had the pleasure of working with Dr. Gibson. So Dr. Gibson, could you introduce yourself to the audience with what you do in and also out of the classroom?
Sure. Hi there. So I'm an anatomic pathologist, and I'm a little bit unique because we're at an academic institution, and I'm not as specialized as many people tend to be. I do cytopathology. So I'm board certified, did a fellowship in cytopathology. So I look at single cells in cytopathology and fine needle aspirations. I actually see patients, you know, who may be sent to us to do fine needle aspirations. I'm very integral in kind of the diagnosis at the patient bedside in cytopathology, but I'm also a surgical pathologist where I do head and neck pathology and renal pathology. And you know me as the kidney person, that's the renal part. And then I'm also an autopsy pathologist. So I do hospital autopsies with our autopsy team. That's what I do for work. And as part of that, I teach, obviously. I teach medical students, I teach residents, I teach my clinical colleagues, and I have many administrative roles in addition to that. We won't go into all that. And outside of work, I've got a family and three grown kids and two dogs. And yeah, I'd like to be outside and spending time with, you know, the family and the dogs.
Thanks so much for walking us through all your different roles. I didn't know that you were an autopsy pathologist as well. So how do you kind of work that all into a day's work? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, so we actually do our schedule for 6 months at a time. And depending on the 6 months and where I'm needed, I could be scheduled for more autopsy service versus, you know, surgical pathology service or cytology service. It's all kind of, you know, where the need is and how much of each. But there's a set amount of service time that I do and the set amount of administrative time that I have. And usually I'm not on autopsy at the same time as I'm on cytology because I can't be in two places at once. Rarely it will happen where I'll have to do two things at once, but I'll have a day or a couple of days in a row of autopsy service and then a couple of days in a row of, say, head and neck and then cytology and then kidneys. It's all the time. So I'm the only person who looks at medical kidney biopsies. And so, you know, and I get anywhere from 3 to 5 a week of those, but that will happen while I'm on other things.
Speaking of kidney biopsies and also your role in teaching, because you play a huge part in the CRR curriculum, specifically for renal pathology, we were introduced to descriptions of different histological findings, such as tram tracks and crescent signs and many more. So for you, what pathognomonic finding would be your favorite and why?
I think that the spikes on the Jones silver stain would be my favorite. Colloquials call it Spike Jones. It's a really distinctive feature that you typically only see in membranous glomerulopathy. There can be lots of different causes of membranous. And I think it's just it's a cool, quick, like, wow, that's membranous. But now membranous is so much more than it ever was. 12 years ago, approximately, people started discovering that we actually now know some of the causes and that membranous is an autoimmune disease. And that's been so worked out over the last 12 years that it's amazing how medicine continues to progress and our learning changes all the time. So I think it's just a cool example of it, of how we learn and how we can change our treatments from this very generic umbrella treatment to now very specific treatment based on which type of membranous somebody has.
No, I love that you said that. And we have such specific treatments now that are so tailored to the patient's diagnoses and this increase in technology that's allowing us to make these diagnoses. And I think one thing that I've really appreciated, especially from your teaching with pathology and studying histology, is that medicine is really such an art and a science when you're looking at these beautiful pictures essentially under the microscope or through staining mechanisms. And it really combines the two and makes you appreciate both. So you definitely showed us that.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think nephrology, renal pathology or nephropathology is one of those specialties where you have to know a lot of medicine and stay up with what's happening, because so much is evolving so quickly that, you know, we're learning all the time and things are changing all the time. And it's hard to keep up, but it's fun that way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sure it's hard to keep up, especially with all the other responsibilities and duties that you're juggling. You kind of touched on this earlier, but I was hoping that you could walk us all through your residency and fellowship experiences with pathology and also kind of how you ended up here.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have to start back into medical school. So I came to medical school thinking I'd be primary care doc. That's what I had known, seen. I didn't have, you know, anyone in my family, but it was kind of what I had seen in the world and had experienced. And then I got to medical school, loved the first year and a half of the Basic Sciences Foundation, and then did my clinical clerkship. And as going through the clinical clerkship, I was like, I can't see myself doing any of these things. It's not that I didn't like them, but it just was like, there's something missing. There's something missing. This is not what I thought it was going to be. And so I was actually considering stepping out of medical school. And at that point decided to do the pathology student fellowship, which I think we might talk about later. Because I was like, okay, the pathologists they know a lot. They get to, you know, teach a lot, which I like. And this will give me a year to try to figure out if medicine is really the right thing for me. I'm going to take this year. So I was accepted into the student fellowship, and I realized within a month that I had found my people. I had found my calling. I'd found my career, that it was this diagnostic medicine that really stimulated my mind all the time. And so that I was able to, in pathology, study the pathology, put the pieces of the puzzle together that other people weren't putting together. I mean, I started on autopsy, and it was like, we were figuring things out that people couldn't figure out while the patient was alive. Being able to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and to give that answer to the clinical team and to the family was so rewarding. And I just was like, this is what I want to do. I want to be able to provide the answers, put the pieces of the puzzle together. And so I said at that point, okay, pathology is for me. And when I went back into medical school after the student fellowship, I geared the rest of my fourth year, you know, obviously I had my requirements, but my electives all towards what could make me a better pathologist. What do I need to know to be a better doctor's doctor? So that's what we consider pathology, right? Is the doctor's doctor. So we're often giving our answers directly to other providers and communicating directly with providers. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know, I did GI, I did dermatology, things that I knew that would people who would be sending a lot of samples to pathology, what do I need to know from them? What are they looking for? Hem-onc, that kind of thing. You know, so I did those kind of rotations. And then when I did pathology residency, it was 5 years. Now it's 4 years, and you do what's called anatomic pathology and clinical pathology. So anatomic pathology is the study of tissues under the microscope, and clinical pathology is really the rest of laboratory medicine. So it's everything that encompasses the testing that we do within the laboratory. And then I did the fellowship in cytopathology. So I did 5 years of residency and then a fellowship in cytopathology. And I did that all here. So I stayed here. At the time I had gotten married, I actually had a kid during residency, I had a kid during fellowship, and then as an early attending, I had my third child. So I was able to kind of fit all that in while doing my residency and fellowship.
That is a great story. I think it's so interesting to hear how folks kind of maybe shift what their passions are throughout medical school. And honestly, it's quite reassuring to hear that somebody like you kind of had a shift in what you ended up doing for your future, because I think oftentimes we in medical school feel like, oh my gosh, what if things change? What's going to happen? So it's reassuring to hear that that's normal and that it happens and that you're so happy doing what you're doing now.
Yeah. And take the time. And the thing is, I personally feel that medical school is not long enough for people to really make a well-informed decision, or for many people to make a really well-informed decision. Some people know right away, right? They what works for them, and other people, it takes a lot longer. So there are other things like transitional years, or start with one thing and switch to another. I know many people have switched into other specialties, and specifically going from clinical specialties into pathology. You know, yes. Are you setting back the clock a little? Yes. Are you taking more time? Yeah. And that may create its own challenges, but to find what is your passion is the most important thing. You don't want to be going to a job every day and calling it a job and not like a career or a calling.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think you spoke a little bit about this, just how you had to prepare to be a clinical pathologist by doing these rotations in GI and just making sure that you had a breadth of knowledge and a vast amount of knowledge to be the best pathologist that you could be. Could you potentially talk about how, just explain your role as a clinical pathologist in the multidisciplinary team that you currently are in? And you spoke a little bit about communicating with providers on a daily basis, and more about that.
Sure. So, you know, if I put on my cytopathology hat, in cytopathology, as the study of kind of single cells, like I had mentioned, we're at the bedside when biopsies are being performed. So we're there to look at the samples as soon as they come out of the patients, to immediate. And so we can give feedback to the proceduralist, the person who's doing the procedure, to say, yeah, you're getting this. This is what I'm thinking. Does that go along with what you're thinking about for the differential diagnosis? And if so, okay, this is the type of triage that we need to do. Or, you know what, I'm seeing something totally different. And so it's the type of communication that we have to have. We have to be very frank, very clear about what we're seeing, because somebody's got a needle in their chest, or, you know, in their liver, or, you know, in one of the organs, and we're trying to figure out what the next steps are. And so before that even happens, we have, you know, some algorithms that we have an approach to, because we know that, you know, for a newly diagnosed lung cancer, we're going to need to have certain types of samples to do advanced testing if they have an advanced lung cancer. So we're going to have to do that. So we already know what we're going to do. But if you run into something that's totally unexpected, it's like, this is not what you thought it was. This is a totally different tumor or infection or something like that. We need to switch gears. You just have to be really clear. The radiologist typically has to be very clear too. So I mean, it's unsafe for me to get you more. It's just so important that we're just having those conversations right there as the patient's undergoing the procedure. And then obviously afterwards, communicating at the multidisciplinary conferences about the final diagnosis and all the ancillary studies that were done to help support that diagnosis. That's just one example, slightly different from a kidney biopsy standpoint, but I'm present for most of the kidney biopsies too. I try to be on site when they're obtaining a kidney biopsy to tell them whether they have enough of the parts of the kidney that I need to see, or I send them back for more if it's safe.
Yeah, I like that you drew that conclusion or that link between radiology and pathology, because I feel like those are both specialties that you're mostly communicating with other physicians. And I think going into those careers as medical students, at least we're under the impression that you're not really getting a lot of patient face-to-face interaction, but it seems to be the opposite for you, where you're getting the patient interaction, but then you're also getting the clinician interaction, which is a nice point to make.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, as I said, as cytopathologists, people can refer their patients directly to us if they have a palpable mass. So one that we're not going to use ultrasound or anything, we can just palpate, say a thyroid mass or a neck mass or a nodule on the skin. They can refer the patient to us and we can meet the patient. It's more like a surgical interaction, you know, take a limited history and physical and do the procedure right there. And depending on the results and whether I can give patients enough information, I will give them the information that I have based on looking under the microscope right outside their room.
That's really amazing. And a nice thing to think about when you're choosing a path for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So, I mean, often people think of pathology as like we're in the lab and the, you know, it's kind of a black box and you're not interacting. And it's amazing how much pathologists have to communicate and how many people they're interacting with. And that some of us as pathologists actually interact directly with patients. So, you know, as cytopathologists, we do autopsy pathologists. I'm directly interacting with families. We're getting autopsy consent directly from families, answering their questions in the some of the worst times of their life, you know, and talking to them right after their family members have died and try to, you know, reassure them that we're going to try to get the answers that they're seeking and then following up with the families. Yeah, those are just some of the patient interactions that we have.
Also, it's pretty varied in terms of patient interaction. So that's cool also, especially for folks that think that pathologists don't really interact with patients at all. I'm sure to hear that there's so many patient interaction opportunities is really interesting and fascinating. Kind of thinking about interpersonal connections, what are your support systems look like in the clinic and beyond?
So one of the things I think that is unique about pathology is that we don't have the patient 95% of the time right in front of us. And so we can actually take more time to spend with the patient's samples and consult our colleagues all the time. So we're constantly working together on cases. We're constantly, on a daily basis, we have what's called consensus conferences or consultation conferences where we're showing each other challenging cases and that we've got the input of others. And if necessary, we'll, you know, do more stains, do more special studies, or we'll send it out to a colleague at another institution and get another opinion if necessary. So there's lots of ways to refer, you know, and it's not this formal, oh, now I've got to send the patient to someone else for consultation. It's like, no, I'm knocking down the door next door to say, hey, can I show you this case? Or can we, you know, we're going to meet at 3 o'clock to show cases. I've got a great challenging case to show somebody. So I think one of the things that we've always done here is even while a patient's in, say, the operating room and they're having surgery and they need the surgeon find something that they want an intraoperative consultation on. So they want the pathologist to make a diagnosis while the patient's under anesthesia. So that's called a frozen section or an intraoperative consultation. Many institutions, the frozen section room is right next to the OR. So it's like literally right at the OR. So that's where they do all the testing. We've opted to have our frozen section where we all have our offices. So we're not alone. We can always show it to somebody else. So we're in the middle of a frozen section. We, you know, this is a really challenging brain biopsy, let's say, or something. I've got somebody else right there that I can show it to and get another opinion. Because the patient, I mean, there could be changes that the surgeon needs to make based on what we're seeing right there. So those are kind of just some of the supports that we've got. And I think it's that just, it creates a collegial environment to be able to show each other cases all the time. And you feel really confident in your diagnosis when you get to show it to other people.
I also noticed earlier, you said that when you entered into pathology, you found like your people. And so being able to, you know, rely on your colleagues in this way and kind of like feeling a part of a community, I'm sure is an amazing feeling. And I think as physicians or future physicians, we think like, oh, it's scary to be making these diagnoses on our own. So also reassuring to hear that you have each other's support.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's a community. And, you know, as I said, if I don't, you know, if I can't do that, if I don't have anyone here who feels comfortable, you know, and I'm the only renal pathologist, right? So I've got colleagues at Mayo that I send things to all the time. I've got colleagues at Mass General that I know, oh, I'm sending this one to Mass General because I need specific studies that I know that they do. And I actually email my friend at Mass General saying, hey, this is on its way. This is what I'm thinking. This is what I'm, you know, and they're like, oh, okay, we'll be expecting it. It's a small world when it comes to pathology.
Yeah. Speaking of community and how you are part of such a huge team of different physicians, working with primary care and how primary care monitors kidney function, how could any primary care physician possibly make your life easier as a pathologist due to your clinical interest in nephrology? How could they monitor kidney function or look for red flags?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there are a couple of things. One is that we know how common diabetes is, right? And so primary care is the main team making sure that, you know, looking for early signs of diabetic damage in the kidney by looking at the protein that is leaking through into the urine is really important. So knowing what that that level is and having that monitored regularly. And I know it's hard sometimes to get patients to follow up, but I think that's been is one of the things I've seen challenges is that once the patient gets to the hospital and they may have been may or may not been adequately followed by primary care, it's like we don't know what their diabetes was doing to their kidney until they're here now. And now we know that they've got, say, nephrotic syndrome. They've got so much protein in their urine that they meet the criteria for nephrotic syndrome, but they've had diabetes for 10 years. So is this a new nephrotic syndrome on top of a very well-managed diabetes? Or is this, was this a chronic progressive change in their kidney function over time? And they started out with a low level of albuminuria and then it got worse and worse and worse. So really monitoring that, how much albumin is in the urine over time and documenting that, I think is would actually save a lot of people biopsies because there are a lot of patients who I get biopsies on who have diabetes and the diagnosis is diabetes. And part of it is it's hard to, you know, not everyone follows the progression the same way, but 95% of the time when they have diabetes, they have diabetic changes. Now, do they have something else on top of it that has changed? Yes. You know, there are definitely patients who have that too, but having that data to know like, oh yeah, this person's the amount of protein that they've been leaking from their kidney has progressed over time and their renal function has diminished over time with that. That's probably going to be diabetes. And unless there's something else that says they have a new disease, that's what we're going to see on biopsy. Monitoring the protein, monitoring the urinalysis, and then the, you know, the creatinine, the renal function, estimated GFR.
Yeah. And would you say that, do you get a lot of referrals from primary care settings or is it from a nephrologist or endocrinology specifically where you're getting the referrals?
Yeah. So most of the patients are going to go to nephrology first. So they're going to go from their primary care to nephrology, unless it's an acute change in which they might get admitted. They might get admitted to surgery. They might get admitted to a primary care team in the hospital. And that team may say, okay, we need to get a kidney biopsy, but often they'll call a nephrology consult too for an inpatient. So usually there's a nephrologist involved who can then say, get a really good history, get the basic laboratories like we've talked about in CRR, including the serologies to say, okay, what's the likelihood of this being a, you know, new disease versus something old, and look at that urine sediment, because nephrology is the, you know, the best eyes on looking at that urine. They're usually spot on at predicting, you know, kind of whether this is a glomerular disease, whether this is a tubular interstitial disease before they do the biopsy.
Yeah. So advice would be for primary care to really look at the urine.
And it's going to be hard. It's going to be send the urine, look at the urinalysis results and make sure that, that somebody's looking at the urine and looking and tracking that the amount of protein and the creatinine over time.
Got it. Thinking about all the different hats that you wear, how do you prioritize and manage your workload effectively, especially during periods of like high volume or critical cases in the lab? How do you know what to put first?
Yeah. So tumor diagnoses and urgent kidney biopsies. So someone who's got an AKI. So those are considered critical diagnoses, right? So if someone has AKI, then I've got to figure out whether, you know, that's going to be a tubular AKI, a glomerular or vascular. Those are typically like, there could be an urgent treatment for that. I need to look at those right away. Somebody comes in with nephrotic syndrome, that's been going on for a while. That can wait. These other patients are going to take priority. And then new tumor diagnoses, like what can we figure out for that and get that processing first. So pap smears are part of cytopathology. A pap smear is not monitoring something that's really acute typically. So that's going to go to the lower part of my pile versus a, you know, a lung biopsy or something like that.
And so I guess a follow-up question that I have, if you get a sample that you deem to be, you know, acute, like an AKI, if the sample comes in the wee hours of the morning, what happens then?
So I'm on call 24/7 unless I'm out of town. So if, you know, I'll get a call on a Friday afternoon or a, you know, call from IR or from the nephrologist saying, we have to have an answer tomorrow. This is an AKI. We think it's an RPGN. It's like, okay, I'll be there. And I call the lab and we've got to kind of, they've got to then reprioritize the making the slides on other patients to get that out for me. So I can get that answer to the clinician, hopefully by, you know, noon on a Saturday.
It's, you know, very demanding, but also really important. Also, are the pathology residents and other, you know, faculty in the lab involved in this process as well?
So usually the pathology residents who are on call will look at the case with me, but they are also juggling multiple different high priority issues with patients over the weekends. And so depending on that, I will review it with them, but they don't have to take ownership of it because they're taking ownership of all the transfusion reactions and massive transfusion protocols and things like that with the blood bank that are happening and new leukemia and lymphoma diagnoses at the same time. So, you know, it doesn't stop over the weekend with people getting new diagnoses and, you know, really critical things. So, but the residents are involved. If I'm out of town, then we send the entire case to Mayo and Mayo will turn it around as quickly as possible. They'll know that it's stat. They won't necessarily do it on a Saturday, but they'll have it out, you know, first thing Monday morning.
That was very helpful and informative. Thank you.
Dr. Gibson, with communicating different critical results to different specialties, do you find yourself mostly communicating through Epic and doing it more through a virtual conversation? Or would you say that it is more face-to-face or you try and do it on the phone to give a thorough explanation depending on the result?
Yeah. You know, now that we have a great electronic system, I think there's more of it that's going electronically than in the past where it was typically a phone call. But there are complexities to these diagnoses that I feel like phone calls are much better. So I will reach out. Yeah, let's say it's a transplant kidney biopsy. They can be pretty complex. And so I'll reach out via secure chat or something saying, hey, you got time to talk about this kidney? And we'll set up a time to go through it. And then often, depending on the nephrologist, especially the transplant team, they want to come see the biopsy. They also see the importance of looking at it to help them process what they're going to do next.
And do you find yourself explaining a lot to the patients with these critical diagnoses, or do you mostly leave it to the main physician managing their care?
Yeah, mostly the physicians managing their care. You know, okay. Occasionally the patients, but that's less frequent. But the patients get our diagnoses. As soon as I hit the button to sign out a case, it goes immediately to the portal. So everyone sees it at the same time. So for me, if it's a new and unexpected diagnosis and it's going to have a huge impact for the patient, I'm really careful about making sure that I've communicated verbally to the clinician first so they're aware, because some of these are very unexpected diagnoses.
Yeah, and I could see how that could be overwhelming to a patient that they open on Epic and they see all these big words that are intimidating and could cause more stress and anxiety. So communication's important.
Really is. And it is, it's become more challenging now that patients get the results at the exact same time as the clinicians.
So thinking again about the collaborative nature of pathology, naturally working with others, you're going to have differences of opinion. So could you walk us through how you would go about having a conversation regarding a difference in opinion with another provider?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm really curious about how you all came up with some of these questions. I think that really being open to realizing that we may all have bias, that we may have cognitive bias, is really important to say, okay, you know, what's the most important thing for the patient here? Because I could, you know, completely stick to my guns and say, this is this diagnosis. And somebody else may say, well, no, I really think it's this diagnosis. And it's like, okay, you know, are we on the same general path here, or are we on different, totally different planes? You know, if we're on the same general path, you know, are these subtle differences that will matter to the treatment of the patient or not? And if it matters, we need to get a third opinion. We need someone else. We need an outside opinion to help resolve that. And sometimes we'll even struggle with what seems to be minor, but there are some really gray areas sometimes, especially in head and neck pathology. Oral dysplasia is really challenging. So squamous dysplasia of the oral cavity can be super hard. And some of these lesions are just super challenging. So you know what? We both feel like this is dysplasia, but we're at different levels. And, you know, this one's just one we need to learn about. You know, we need to learn from the expert too and do the best thing for the patient. Let's send it out. Let's see what another expert says about this, because it's going to change the follow-up for that patient potentially. So we got to put your ego aside and just, you know, what's best. And sometimes we go into a case, thinking about a patient scenario with bias already. We're influenced by the history and we're not staying broad enough to say, oh, wait, you know, that's what this could be. So you got to stay open.
Definitely. And it's interesting that you kind of wonder how Katie and I come up with these questions. I think that obviously we get together and brainstorm and have a session, but these are kind of questions based on some of our biggest fears, I think, of medicine, right? These things were sure come up, like disagreements with colleagues and, you know, timing and scheduling, managing your workload. So I think it's just, you know, our natural thought processes thinking about this and thinking about how we would handle this in the future, especially with clerkships coming up soon. So those are definitely good pointers. It sounds like, you know, putting your ego aside, and if you still can't come to an agreement, asking or phoning another friend, we definitely will take your advice.
Yeah. And definitely thinking about your biases, right? Because we sometimes will hear enough of the patient's story that we kind of start going down this one path of their diagnosis. And we need to reel back and say, okay, what else did I miss? Can I stay more broad so that we're not like just pigeonholing and saying, oh yeah, you know, this is tumor, this is tumor. No. Actually, this could be, you know, an odd infection, or, you know, let's stay broad.
Absolutely. And Dr. Gibson, speaking about the pathology student fellowship program that you yourself did, I have just a couple questions about it specifically. When you're planning on enrolling in this program, you were saying how you were able to choose rotations in your fourth year to give you the best holistic education to prepare you to be a pathologist. So is there a certain time frame that would be better to do the pathology program if you're a candidate and you're interested in this, of doing it between third and fourth year? Or is it a problem if you do it after fourth year? And who would be an ideal candidate for this program?
Great questions again. So most people choose to do it after their third year. It's kind of, you know, designed for that. So you finish your clinical clerkship year and, you know, start after that. And it's a master's level degree now. So you actually, you're stepping out of medical school, but you're stepping into the graduate school. And so part of the credits that you earned in the foundations of medicine and clinical clerkship will go towards your master's degree. And then there are certain requirements that you'll have to do, you know, a certain number of credit rotations in pathology, and then some specific other credits that you'll have to do, including research credit and things like that. And then, I mean, the culmination is really to learn as much as you can about, you know, medicine and pathology. So not everyone who opts to do the student fellowship is thinking they want to go into pathology. For me, it was like, it's a possibility. I'd love to see what it's like, but I need to step out and just see if medicine is right for me. And I learned so much medicine during that year. So it's a dedicated year. It's like doing an extra internship year, but you're an intern in pathology, but you get to see all the laboratory testing, all the, you know, really complex cases in the hospital come through pathology. And so you get to learn a lot of medicine, and people realize whether this is right for them or not, but they understand now how to navigate the laboratory, how to navigate for their patients, the testing that their patients need, and learn a lot more medicine behind, you know, what they're going to go into. So some people opt to say, oh, you know, I loved microbiology. I'm going to be an infectious disease doc. Now I know exactly what the testing is being done for my patients in infectious disease, or I'm going into hem-onc and like now I understand the whole processing of for the hemoc patients. And so you can be a better doc in whatever you go into a surgeon, you know, if you do this year, but it's people who feel like they can take a year. I think it's hard to slow down this train when you start, you're like, oh, I just want to get through this. I want to get through this. But anyone who's thinking about potentially pathology or really wants to learn more medicine while they're still have got a good parachute, they've got people helping them, right? So you're still an intern, you're being supervised, and you get to learn a lot more medicine and be very hands-on learning, and not necessarily book learning. So I think that those are some of the benefits. And I think it's only about a third of our pathology student fellows go into pathology. Yeah. So a good portion of them don't go into pathology. Very few of them say they wouldn't do it again, you know, that it was such a good learning experience that they would do it again.
Yeah. And how many students are usually chosen to do the program?
We have two at this institution. Yeah. But there are many institutions that offer pathology student fellowships. And we've even had a student from here who's actually done a student fellowship somewhere else. That's not very common because most institutions take their internal students first, but you can try to apply someplace else to do it. Yeah. The student fellowships have been around since probably 1930s.
Oh, wow.
Oh yeah. These are really old programs. And I can't give you the number of institutions that have them, but it's up in the 70s, 80s, a number of programs. Yeah, it's pretty common.
And would you say that this is now becoming sort of a requirement if you are interested in pathology?
No, you don't have to at all. I think if people are interested in pathology, you need to shadow. You need to understand what pathology is like. You need to obviously do at least two intensive rotations in pathology before submitting your ERAS application and everything like that. But you don't have to do a student fellowship. You don't have to at all. You know, we look equally at applicants who've done a student fellowship and who haven't. I mean, obviously a student fellowship, we know for sure, you know what pathology is about, you know, and usually those are, you know, that would be, you know, excellent candidates for resident positions. But there are a lot of people you know, don't take that extra year, and that's fine.
Our final question of the day for you is, what advice do you have for an aspiring pathologist?
Come see what we do. Come see what we do. If you think you really want to do pathology as students, you see us as teachers, which we are, but that's not the major part of what we do every day. That's not the diagnostic part of what we do. And it's really varied. Like, people don't understand how many avenues there are in pathology. So when you say pathology and laboratory medicine, you know, there's 30 different career avenues in pathology and laboratory medicine. So there's so much more, just like in internal medicine, right? You've got lots of different avenues that if you don't come and see what each of us do, or at least get a snapshot, you're not going to realize that the breadth of opportunities.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gibson, for being our guest. This was an amazing interview, and I personally know that I learned so much from this. So thanks for joining us today.
I'm so glad I could be here. Thank you.
All right, folks. If you're still here, thanks for sticking with us. That's it for today on Green Mountain Medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our discussion, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @ACP_Vermont for more podcast updates, or subscribe to us on YouTube at Green Mountain Medicine.